Chapter 11. Grandma Nora, 3 years ago. Everything that Ray knew about the violin came from Grandma Nora, of course, and the bulk of what he'd learned came from a few all too short weeks that Ray spent with her when he was a sophomore. One rainy April evening, his Aunt Rochelle called to tell him that Grandma Nora had been diagnosed with lung cancer. "Typical Mama," she'd said, voice thick with tears. "They're saying she only has about 6 weeks. And I just wanted to let you know in case you wanted to come see her." He hung up and immediately booked the 9-hour bus trip to Atlanta. When he arrived at his grandmother's house, no walker, no pink housecoat, and no smiling face awaited him as he trudged up the path to the front porch. He rang the bell, and Uncle Larry answered, embraced him. "How's she doing?" Ray asked. He shook his head. "She's a tough old lady, but it's not looking good."
"Is everyone here?"
"Rochelle is coming in tonight. Everybody else is here."
"My mom too?"
"Yeah, she's in the kitchen."
As Ray edged past him into the foyer, Larry put a hand on his arm.
"Ray, when you go in to see your grandma, know that she's lost a lot of weight. I don't want you to be shocked."
Inside, everyone hugged him or rubbed his shoulders. Even his mom stood up and gave him a very fake, very tactile hug.
"Go see your grandmother. Don't stay in there too long. She needs to rest."
Aunt Joyce, sitting next to the bed, stood up when she saw him. He took her place. Grandma Nora was a shell, the color drained from her face. There was no sparkle in her eyes. He wasn't sure she even recognized him. Even if she did, Ray doubted she could muster the strength to even give him the hug he desperately needed. He sat down, took her hand, careful to be gentle.
"Grandma."
The word caught in his throat. She didn't speak. She didn't move. He tried again.
"I came to see you."
He was losing the struggle not to cry. He kept blinking.
"How are you feeling?"
"Oh, baby. I don't think Grandma is doing too good. They tell me I have cancer, baby."
"Grandma, I'm so sorry. What can I do for you?"
Ray gave up on trying to hold back his tears.
"All you can do is what you always do. You make me so proud."
She took a breath. It hurt to watch.
"I'm happy to hear that you're playing your fiddle good."
"I'm doing my best, Grandma. Every day I'm trying so hard to make you proud."
His voice broke.
"I know you do, baby. Did you bring it?"
A breath.
"Your fiddle. You're gonna take it out and play for me?"
"Of course."
He stood to retrieve the instrument case, which he'd left in the living room.
"I don't think she means right now,"
Aunt Joyce said softly from the doorway. He hadn't realized she was still there.
"Why don't we let her rest for a little? You want to sleep a little bit, Mama?" "Yes, baby. Maybe I'll rest a bit. And then Ray can bring up his fiddle for me."
"Okay,"
Ray said. He sat back down and reached for her hand again. He sat with her as she slept. The next few weeks passed in a blur, taking turns at her bedside, and when he couldn't be with her, he sat in the hallway, staring blankly at his textbook, A History of Western Music. He played for her whenever he could, The Lark Ascending, and Defia's Spanish Dance, always finishing with Rosa Madre. Often she'd talk, drifting in and out of consciousness. She seemed desperate to tell him as much as she could about her family, especially her grandfather, and Ray was desperate to hear, as if injecting her memories would allow her to live on.
"Whose fiddle is that?"
she asked him the first morning he was back as he opened the violin case.
"You said you'd brought Pop-Pop's fiddle."
"This is Pop-Pop's fiddle," he said, showing it to her.
"Why isn't it in the case? The one with the loose handle. It's green inside."
"You mean the alligator skin case? It's under my bed at school. I just wanted something to protect Pop-Pop's fiddle a little better," he explained.
"That's good, baby. That's real good. Sure wish you'd brought it, though."
Then she told him what she remembered about the violin. Much he'd already heard, but some was new. Her grandfather, Leon, had been born into slavery on a Georgia plantation outside Atlanta. She didn't know the plantation's name. He'd learned to play his fiddle as a child. Grandma Nora wasn't clear how. The slaveholders, the Marks family, had come to Georgia a generation before, maybe 30 or 40 years earlier, from somewhere in Italy. The Marks family had built the plantation house, bought slaves, and tried to assimilate into Southern culture. "Is that where you learned Italian?" Ray had never put it together, but he suddenly remembered that, when he was little, his grandma would sometimes say some words in a different language.
"Yes, baby. You remember pronto? I'd say that when the pies were finished cooking. You sure loved my blueberry pie."
"I sure did," he said. By the time Leon was a young man, he would play regularly for his master.
"He always told us about playing after dinner and for the parties at the big house. He told me how much he loved playing at them parties."
They would dance on weekends and celebrate when the harvest was in. On Sundays after church, if the field slaves didn't have to return to work, he played for them too.
"He knew playing that fiddle kept him and his family alive, baby."
The fiddle made him valuable. Although it had apparently always been in the Marks family, no one had played the fiddle like Leon could. When the master was upset, Leon's playing made him smile. When slaves were exhausted at the end of the day, his playing made them get up and dance. He could soothe crying babies and impress crowded parlors. Grandma Nora said that Leon and his master were close. Ray wondered if the master was Leon's biological father. After the war between the states, the master freed all his slaves. He gave Leon the fiddle, telling him how happy Leon's playing had made him and his family.
"That's all Pop-Pop had in the world when he left that plantation, baby. Just that fiddle. He played every chance he could. He played that fiddle every day. Every single day."
Leon was very superstitious and thought his homemade rosin, his good luck dust, made him a good musician, and that it was bad luck to wipe it off. Grandma Nora remembered that whenever Leon picked it up, white fingerprints dusted the fiddle's body. The violin case had an interesting story. The slave cabins were perched on the edge of a swamp, probably to make it harder for the enslaved people to run away. Alligators lived in the swamp, sometimes eating the chickens and the goats that roamed freely around the cabins. One particularly big alligator would lurk offshore, its yellow eyes gleaming in the firelight, drifting lazily in the water until it lunged onto the bank, dragging its prey down. Three or four of the enslaved men caught and killed it, and one of them turned that skin into a fiddle case. He inlaid the case with scraps of dark green velvet brought special from Savannah for the mistress's gown. When Leon moved to Atlanta, he first supported himself by playing at local parlors or at musical events, sometimes accompanying itinerant singers or other musicians. When he married Annabeth Wines, though, his days as a musician ended. He spent the next 40 years working in a lumber mill. But that fiddle remained his obsession, and he played for them every night. None of his children or grandchildren had any interest in music, so after his death, the fiddle sat unused in Nora's home. She'd perhaps opened the case a dozen times in the next 50 years.
"He was a good man," she told Ray. "And oh, he would have been so proud of you. Pop-Pop always had a kind word for everyone, no matter how nasty someone treated him. He always said, 'Respect yourself, and people will respect you too.' It has to start with you, Nora. He'd say to me, 'No matter how they treat you, you just remember that you're worthy of respect.' I can hear his voice right now, baby. 'You're worthy, Nora,' he'd tell me."
She looked at Ray.
"I never forgot that."
Medicine bottles stood like sentries on top of her nightstand. Aunt Joyce, Aunt Rochelle, and Ray were the ones who memorized her medication schedule and knew when to add dolacetron to ease her nausea or to cut back on FECT, the chemotherapy drug, when she complained of headaches. Aunt Rochelle never tried to make him leave the room. That time a few years ago in the music shop, when the racist clerk had yelled at him, had formed a special bond between them. Ever since then, she'd go out of her way to ask him about music or get him to play for the family. She was unmarried, a paralegal in a big law firm outside Philadelphia, and Ray wondered if she sometimes thought of him as the son she never had. He sometimes wished he had been. Almost 3 weeks after Ray arrived in Georgia, Aunt Rochelle came upstairs with Grandma Nora's lunch. Ray was sitting by her bed.
"Mama," Aunt Rochelle said loudly, "time for lunch. Made you some fresh tomato soup. I know how you like your tomato soup."
"I can feed it to her," he said, taking the bowl. Grandma Nora opened her eyes, smiled at him.
"Tomato soup," he said,
lifting the spoon to her mouth. She kept her mouth closed, just smiled at both of them.
"Don't you feel like eating?" he asked. "No, baby. I don't think so. Not today."
"Now you eat that soup," Aunt Rochelle told her. "It's your own recipe, and I know how you like it. Joyce made it for you special."
"In a little while, then,"
Grandma Nora said.
"Okay,"
Ray said. "I'll put it right here until you feel like eating."
"How about I get you some tea?"
Aunt Rochelle suggested.
"We have a fresh pot, and it has honey in it. Good for your immune system. I'll be right back."
When Ray and his grandmother were alone, she smiled at him even more broadly, struggled to lift the arm with the IV in it, brushed her fingers against his cheek. He reached for her hand as she caressed his face.
"Baby, one of the best things that I've ever been able to do is to say how proud I am of you. You always bring a smile to my face. You've stayed so sweet, even when you're sad. That's why I love you so much."
Ray was about to speak and lay her arm down when she sighed. The sound loud in the room, deep, as if she were expelling air from the very depth of her being.
"Promise me something."
Her breathing got heavy, growling, a deep rumble.
"Of course," he said. "Grandma, you okay? Promise me you'll always stay that sweet boy Grandma loves so much. Okay?"
The rattle in her chest grew louder.
"Okay. Of course."
He went to the doorway. "Aunt Rochelle? Hey, Aunt Joyce? Can you come in here a sec?" They were there immediately, Aunt Rochelle clutching the teacup.
Sit me up, baby.
Ray knew what was happening. She wanted to be ready when it was time for her to go home.
Can somebody do something?
Ray said. His voice came out as a squeak. Aunt Joyce and Aunt Rochelle were blocking his view of her.
Mama,
Aunt Joyce was saying, leaning over and holding Grandma Nora's hand.
Mama,
she said again. But this time, it wasn't a question. The new silence in the room crashed around him. Chapter 12. Authentication, 14 months ago. Dr. Stevens pinched the bridge of her nose, thinking.
So the Italian connection certainly adds to the possibility that this is a Strad, although it's hard to imagine a 19th century plantation owner giving an expensive violin like this to a freed slave, she mused.
I always wondered if he was actually Pop-Pop's biological father,
Ray said.
Still, she said, it's hard to believe, which is why we're going to New York to an expert,
she said, standing up.
Let's get the violin.
Jacob Fisher smiled when they entered, lifting an off-white case with black leather trim, a Tonarelli fiberglass case which easily cost $300, onto the counter. Ray had never seen a case like that in person before. He pulled it toward him. The case felt empty, as if it were filled with air or filled with light. Gingerly, he folded back the emerald-colored top cloth, revealing a violin that was at once familiar and utterly, staggeringly the most beautiful object he'd ever seen. His great-great-grandfather's fiddle was unrecognizable. The beat-up old body, coated with decades of good luck dust, had been buffed to a deep, fiery orange. The cheap plastic tailpiece had become an ornately hand-carved, ebony work of art. The bridge was handcrafted and placed perfectly beneath the strings. Every crack, every scar, had vanished. Jacob had taken ebony pegs and ornamented each tip with mother-of-pearl. The back was perfectly polished, the red and orange glowing like sunrise. Dr. Stevens was smiling more than he'd ever seen her smile, and her eyes were bright.
Why don't you play it a little? Jacob said. Check out the improvements. See if you can tell the difference.
Ray played two notes and stopped. He couldn't breathe. The sound was unlike anything he'd ever heard before. The notes more resonant, as if reaching into the marrow of his bones. He drew in a shaky breath. He realized he was crying, but couldn't even wipe away his tears. What a gift his grandmother had given him. How would he ever be worthy?
Promise me, you'll always stay that sweet boy Grandma loves so much.
He promised her again, right then, that he would keep working twice as hard to make her proud. He took another breath, then played the adagio from Mozart's third violin concerto. He'd never felt such joy before. It was as if his heart were in all his fingers, playing. When at last he drew his bow over the final chords, the room continued to echo.
Ray, are you okay?
He was thinking of his great-great-grandfather. He was thinking of Grandma Nora. He was struggling to find words. So instead he looked at Dr. Stevens and at Jacob.
Thank you.
No, son. Thank you. This was an absolute treasure.
It's stunning, Dr. Stevens breathed. May I?
Ray handed it to her.
Were you able to determine the date?
Jacob shook his head.
The labels long disappeared. My best guess is that it's from between 1720 and 1730.
They talked for a while longer, Then Ray paid Jacob his $1,500 fee and the cost of the new case, and they left, planning next steps. If this were an Italian 18th century violin, it needed to be authenticated by an expert and probably insured. Janice now informed Ray that he would be making an appointment in New York City with Misha Roland, one of the top Italian violin experts in the country, for Monday morning. Going through Charlotte's airport security was anxiety-inducing. He'd seen Pop-Pop's fiddle go through the X-ray machine dozens of times, but this was the first time he'd watched a $300 white case cradling a Stradivarius, his Stradivarius, float away into the X-ray machine. Being separated even so briefly from the violin now made Ray slightly nauseated. He wondered if this was how the rest of his life would be, glued unceasingly to this violin, forever. Would he take it into the shower with him? He'd be taking it to the Tchaikovsky competition, that was for sure. He grinned to himself. 2 hours later, the plane banked for a landing, and there was Manhattan, gleaming in the early morning sunshine like a fairy tale city, all glass and gold. It wasn't a real place. It was something out of a movie, like these past few days. He was just a black kid who hadn't wanted to work at a fried chicken restaurant, and now he was a musician, and there, spread out like a Thanksgiving feast, was New York City. He couldn't believe this was real. After they landed, though, JFK Airport's grime coating every institutional beige surface jolted him back to reality. Dr. Stevens, Ray, you need to call me Janice now, not Dr. Stevens, had planned on an hour to get into the city, and they needed every minute of it, sitting in their taxi in bumper-to-bumper traffic nearly the whole way. Ray couldn't imagine how people did this every morning. At 9:04 a.m., their taxi passed Carnegie Hall, and a few moments later pulled up in front of a nondescript beige building. Roland's Fine Instruments Sales and Appraisals, established 1927, was stenciled in ornate gold lettering across the plate glass window. Inside, a single violin, encased in clear plexiglass, stood proudly. Their appointment was for 9:00. "Good timing, huh?" Dr. Stevens said. They had to ring a bell to be buzzed into the main showroom, where a faded violet couch sat against one wall, a beat-up coffee table covered with magazines in front of it. Instruments hung from everywhere, including the ceiling. Violins, violas, and cellos shone with a gorgeous luster like nothing he'd ever seen. These were the instruments of princes and kings, the violins for the best violinists in the world. On the counter rested an old-fashioned cash register. No electronics, no card reader. Behind the counter, a staircase carpeted in red damask led up into darkness. On one side of the steps hung an enormous sign, "Employees only." On the other, "All others keep out." The room seemed deserted, but moments after they arrived, a voice boomed from the stairwell.
"You have kept me waiting. Your appointment was for 9, and it was a serious inconvenience to fit you in."
A very large man descended.
"Janice Stevens and Ray McMillan?"
He was very intimidating, easily 6'4", with jet black hair slicked back to reveal a high forehead and bright blue eyes. He did not offer to shake either Ray's or Janice's hand.
"Let me see this instrument."
Ray set the case down on the glass cabinet behind them. Misha Roland leaned forward, expressionless, and then lifted out the violin, turned it around, even, Ray could swear, sniffing it. Misha pulled out a jeweler's loop and did it all again.
"I will give you $10,000 for it," the man said. He had a thick accent that Ray couldn't place. "Not a penny more."
"What?" "No, we'd like it appraised," Ray said.
"This is an assessment and appraisal," Janice put in.
Roland shook his head.
"15,
Cash.
$15,000 could buy a lot of violins, could pay travel costs for auditions, could set him up on his feet.
I'm sorry, Ray said. It's really not for sale.
25, and that is my very final offer.
It's been in my family for years, Ray said. I'm not selling it. Ever.
Excuse us, Janice said, pulling Ray's arm.
A few feet away, she said quietly,
You sure you don't want to reconsider?
This is a lot of money. Jacob can find you a great violin for that.
Ray turned back to the man, took the violin gently from him.
I'm not selling, Ray said. I can't sell my grandma's violin. I'm going to keep this for the rest of my life and pass it down to my kids.
Roland nodded once.
I expected as much. Come.
With no further comment, he turned, retreated up the red damask steps. They threaded behind the counter and followed him. At the top of the stairs, heavy metal doors glowered. Ray gripped the violin more tightly. Roland pulled out an elaborate key. When he turned it, a keypad with numbers lit up. He pressed a sequence, and the heavy door opened smoothly. They found themselves in a room that ran the entire length of the building. The space filled with cases, instruments, work tables, tools, and what looked to be a well-equipped scientific laboratory. One table held the back of a cello with electrodes bored into it. On another, a violin lay on its side, with six magnifying glasses surrounding it from multiple angles. Although it was just after 9 a.m., several people in white aprons seemed to be engaged in important tasks.
Lay your violin here, and take a seat.
Ray placed his case on a table lined with maroon velvet. Roland put on a pair of white gloves and opened the violin case.
Alexa, he said to the room, play old school hip-hop.
Within moments, the Beastie Boys' music pumped through wall-mounted speakers around the room. Under bright lights on the velvet-lined table, Roland began his appraisal. Lamps suspended on pulleys from the ceiling lit the violin from every angle as he, jeweler's loop over one eye, focused on every inch, traced every curve, every corner, pulling down different colored lights, changing the lighting and the colors, flipping through dozens of magnifying glasses of different intensities. Every few minutes, he'd pause, write down something, and then resume his examination. Finally, at about 1:15 p.m., Ray's stomach was rumbling, and he was just about to ask if they could order something from a local deli. Roland abruptly stood up, violin in hand.
It is done, he said.
It is? What do you think? Janice asked.
Ray braced himself. Instead, unexpectedly, Roland grinned. His blue eyes lit up. Ray couldn't help smiling back.
Now that I am done, Roland said, I would like to ask permission to play this violin, since you will not sell it to me.
That wasn't what Ray was expecting, but he said,
Yeah. Sure, of course, go ahead.
He and Janice looked at each other. Janice shrugged.
Thank you, young man.
Roland took out Ray's bow and tightened it so it was just off the wood.
Alexa, stop.
From the speakers, Lil Wayne's voice cut off. Ray had seen videos of Bohemian, Gypsy, and Bluegrass players using very loose bows, but had never seen it in person. Then Roland busted out with an incredible display of virtuosity. His fingers flew up and down the fingerboard. Ray was astounded that someone with such large hands could move them so dexterously. The more he played, the more possessed he looked. He drew the bow in one final flourish, stared at the violin for a moment, and then handed it to Ray, bowed slightly.
Jacob Fisher did an exceptional job on this violin. Please pack your instrument away. I will meet you downstairs.
What? Roland's forefinger waved him silent, then gestured for him to return the violin to its case. Wordlessly, he disappeared through a door in one corner of the room. Ray and Janice returned down the stairs. After about 20 minutes, Roland's heavy tread resounded in the stairwell, and a moment later, he appeared, carrying a leather-bound folder.
"Jacob Fisher is correct," Roland told him. "It is an Italian violin, constructed during the so-called golden age of violin making. This is, without question, one of the better examples. This varnish is exquisite. It cannot be duplicated. Even the fingerboard is well preserved. It is pure ebony. The shape of the body is unique and absolutely unmistakable. It is without question a Stradivarius, and a fine example of one. There is no label, however."
"What?" Ray's mouth had gone completely dry, and his head was pounding. "You were going to offer me $25,000 for it, and it's a Strad? That is fucked up."
"I offered you this before I was certain," Roland said, a bit lamely.
"What's it worth?" Janice asked.
Roland shrugged. "For sale purposes, I believe it would fetch between $9.7 and $10.8 million. For insurance purposes, I would value it at $10.1 million.
A sharp intake of breath from Janice. Ray could only nod. His ribs couldn't expand for him to take in breath. His body had grown cold.
"He needs to insure it, then," Janice said casually.
"He does," Roland said.
20 minutes later, a thin older woman, her graying hair streaked with blonde, had sold Ray a month's worth of insurance for $2,000. A year cost $22,000. Ray had no idea how he would pay for something like that. He slumped back in his chair. Between the insurance, Roland's appraisal fee, and the travel costs to New York, Ray's credit card was maxed out. Outside the office, Roland was waiting for them. They thanked him again.
"I am looking forward to hearing great things from you, young man. Now play."
"What? What?"
"I want to hear you play. I want to hear from the great Macmillan Stradivarius before the world knows its greatness."
"What do you want to hear?"
"Does not matter. You just play."
Ray opened the case and launched into Ravel's Zagon, one of his favorites. The opening adagio starts out rich and full, slightly mournful, announcing his presence with passion and wistfulness. And then it lightens, begins to dance, bob along in the current of life. Excitement and great joy, competing, soaring, grateful, and alive. The violin took over. He wasn't playing notes. He was making music the way Ravel intended, the way Antonio Stradivari intended, the way he always dreamed he could play. He poured out into the air what he was unable to put into words. His gratitude. For this violin, for Janice, for Grandma Nora, for Misha Roland's assessment. A few words transforming his life utterly. "Thank you." He ended the piece with its thunderous final note, opened his eyes. The applause echoed in the showroom. From the stairwell, all of Roland's associates had come down and were clapping as well. With a violin like this, he would be worthy of the Tchaikovsky competition. There was no way they could keep him out, no matter his skin color. Chapter 13. New York City, 13 months ago. Manhattan's skyscrapers and streets can seem unreal on an average day. Now, as he carried a Stradivarius violin, the sunlight was almost a melody. The taxis and town cars shuffled in a dance he could almost anticipate and join. He was Dorothy in a world new with technicolor. He was Alice following a watch-checking white rabbit down a hole. He was Neil Armstrong stepping into a lunar landscape and the future. He owned a Stradivarius violin worth $10 million. Was this even remotely possible? On the street, Janice said to him, "You know something? The instrument you play today, not the one you've been using the past 4 years, has really brought out the confidence in you that's always been there. Nice job with the Ravel." He ducked his head. "We're going to the hotel now. I just got a couple emails that I need to deal with, and then we're going for a celebratory lunch, and then shopping. We're buying you a new wardrobe." "New wardrobe? I was thinking about it in Roland's. It's not just your violin that's being introduced to the world. You will be too. You're going to need to step everything up to the next level. Your appearance is going to have to match your playing. People can be cruel, and they're always looking for something to criticize. We won't give them any ammunition. Do you understand what I'm getting at?" He nodded. Being black meant being watched, and usually not in a good way. So many times he'd walked into a store, and the sales clerks glared at him. He'd been followed up and down aisles in grocery stores. At restaurants, out to dinner with friends, he'd be seated in the back near the kitchen or the restroom. No more. The days of being treated as a second-class citizen would soon be over. "You need more than your one suit. You'll need a couple beautifully tailored suits, a couple blazers, and some high-quality shirts and trousers, and a new tux, plus shoes." "I sure hope my bank account can handle all this." "I sure hope so, too," she said. "If not, we can use mine and you can pay me back. You're going to need something nice for the media interview."
What?
"Media interview?" She explained that this discovery would be news. The university would want to profit from it. This would put the music department on the map. It was an extraordinary story, and she expected even the Charlotte Herald would want to run an article. Maybe the local news would, too. "I'd need to tell my mom," he said.
"Of course. We'll time it so you tell your family, and then we'll sit down with a reporter to break the story. But if you tell them now, I'd worry that somebody will leak it all over social media."
This was all happening far too quickly. His mind was already off, running down the rabbit hole of telling his mother. He was nauseous with nervousness. The rest of the family, Aunt Rochelle especially, would be thrilled. But he wondered how his mother would handle it. The Stradivarius wasn't noise now, that was for sure. The hotel was a few blocks away. Skyscrapers sprang up around them, and everywhere people dashed past, looking determined and energetic. Ray, in his faded jeans, with North Carolina all over him and a $10 million violin strapped to his body, had never felt so out of place.
"This is all so much at once, you know?"
"I do, and it's just the beginning."
She had been looking distractedly down at her phone several times. "When we get to the hotel, you check in, and I'm going to use their business services for a sec."
"No problem."
"Is there anything I can do?"
"Department bureaucracy. It'll just take a few minutes. You can go up to your room and have a few minutes to yourself. I'll text you when I'm ready and we can grab lunch. And then go shopping."
They arrived at the Saint-Jacques Hotel. Revolving doors led into a stark white lobby with an artificial fireplace that took up almost the entire length of one wall. On the other wall, a concierge desk stretched forever. Janice asked the doorman where the business service center was and disappeared, heels clattering, down the marble corridor. Ray carried his red duffel and violin case to the enormous front desk, where two clerks stood some distance from each other, both staring down at their computer monitors. He chose the young blonde woman on the right,
who looked not much older than he was.
Hey, how's it going?
Ray said.
May I help you?
She looked him up and down. He checked to see if he'd spilled anything on his shirt. Nope. Clean polo shirt, clean jeans.
Yes, I'm checking in. Ray McMillan.
She punched a few keys.
I don't seem to have you in our system.
Try Raekwon. He spelled it. He was dimly aware that a well-dressed couple entered the lobby, taking their places in front of the wispy-haired clerk on the left.
I see you booked online, his front desk clerk was saying. I'm afraid that it's late in the day, so all we have left is a single with one twin bed.
I requested a queen-size bed. He searched for the reservation on his phone. My confirmation said it was available.
Yes, I'm sure it did. I'm afraid that this is the last room we have at that price.
I'm not sure I understand, Ray said. I'm booked for two nights in a queen room.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. This is all we have available.
She stared off into space, uninterested.
There we are, the other clerk was saying to the couple.
The man was wearing a long coat that looked expensive. Diamonds glittered in the woman's ears. A queen-size bed, yes? Ray looked over at the other clerk, then at the blonde woman in front of him. She pretended not to notice.
You know what?
Fine, he said. I'll take the twin room. He adjusted his grip on the violin case.
What's your name, ma'am? It's Kara. Will there be anything else?
No, Kara. There won't be anything else. It really is a shame that you are so selective on who to give your nice rooms to here. Maybe I'll overlook this when I'm asked to endorse this hotel.
Did that seriously just happen?
The elevator went up six floors, and he found his room, barely more than a closet, overlooking an air shaft. He put the duffel bag on the leprechaun-sized desk, lay down for a minute on the bed, violin next to him. $10 million. 15 minutes later, Janice texted him, and he joined her in the lobby, violin in tow. They decided to find some place nearby for a late lunch. The doorman gave a friendly nod. Ray stopped.
Hey, man, have you worked here long?
About 9 years, sir.
Please, it's Ray.
Nice to meet you, sir. I'm Mike.
Is it me, or...
The doorman chuckled.
You don't even have to finish that sentence. Trust me, it's not you. That happens all the time. They look at you like you don't belong, like they're doing you a favor. Don't let it get to you.
Thanks.
You know, if I stay here again, I'm going to look for you, okay, Mike?
Thank you, sir.
After they'd headed out, Janice said,
Since you're in New York for the first time, and since we have to celebrate, you need to have a real New York experience. That means New York pizza.
It was an afternoon he never forgot. He left the impoverished student behind and stepped into the shoes of a classical music violin soloist carrying his Grandma Nora's $10 million violin, eating New York pizza, shopping for a new wardrobe at Bloomingdale's. Suits, a tuxedo, blazers and trousers. Everything to be hemmed, tailored, customized. 2 hours later, it was time to pay. He kept worrying about how he would pay for any of this.
Okay, sir. Your total comes to $3,463.47.
Janice handed the sales clerk her credit card.
You'll pay me back, she said to Ray. I think you're good for it.
The next day was a whirlwind. Breakfast in New York, picking up his tailored wardrobe, then the flight back to Charlotte, then meeting Markham University president, Suzanne Herz. Ray showed her the violin, the certificate of authenticity in its leather folder. Herz made a phone call, and soon the university's publicity liaison had joined them. Ray again went through his story. They all agreed that an interview with the Charlotte Herald seemed like a great first step, and that they'd feature a special article about Ray and the violin in the next alumni magazine.
That night, Ray called his mother. They hadn't spoken since Christmas.
Mom, this is very important. Everything is about to change for all of us.
What are you talking about?
I'd like to tell everyone at once. Can you get in touch with everybody? All your brothers and sisters. Let's set up a video call for tomorrow night, 7 p.m.
This better not be something crazy. Ain't nobody got time for craziness.
The next night, one by one, Ray's aunts and uncles joined a video call. When they'd all assembled, he put everyone on mute, glanced over at the violin case for reassurance. Aunt Joyce was mouthing something.
Everyone, I have some news. I found out recently that Pop-Pop's fiddle is worth a lot of money. It was made in Italy around 1724. It's called a Stradivarius. What that means is that my violin is one of the most rare instruments ever made. It's been tested and confirmed. He showed them the certificate of authenticity. It may even be in the local news. People will try to buy it. Some of them may contact you and try to get you to convince me to sell it. They may make some really good offers, but I need you all to understand that the fiddle is not for sale. My plan moving forward is to start playing concerts and recitals. There's a piece that's going to run in the Charlotte Herald tomorrow, and I wanted to let you all know ahead of time. I'm going to take you all off mute now.
Ray's mom was first.
How much is it worth?
It's appraised at about $10 million.
Everyone in the video chat began to scream,
"Are you for real, boy?"
Uncle Thurston got closer and closer to his monitor.
"Yes, I'm being serious."
"Oh my God, if this is real, we are rich," Aunt Joyce screamed. "Lord have mercy, I can't believe this,"
Ray's mom said.
"Ray, what did you do with that fiddle? Where is it?"
Uncle Larry said. Ray sat back in his chair and looked up at the Optimus Prime poster on his wall.
"It's here with me, and I..."
"If we can get $10 million for it, we split it evenly," Thurston said, cutting Ray off. "If we divide it by five, since there are five of us, we each get $2 million, minimum."
He gave a fist pump.
"Ray, you can share with your mama."
"It's Ray's fiddle," Rochelle said. "Maybe he should get a finder's fee." "You want a finder's fee, sugar?"
Ray put them all back on mute.
Wait, everybody. I don't think you understand. I hope I'll be making some pretty good money from my concerts, but I'm not selling my violin."
He turned off the mute.
"Your violin,"
Ray's mom said, as if he had invented a new language.
"Yeah, I'm not selling my violin."
"That was Mama's violin. It belongs to the family."
"Actually, it doesn't. Grandma Nora gave it to me 4 years ago."
"Boy, ain't nobody got time for this craziness," his mother said.
"Once I get on my feet, though, and start making money, I'm planning on sending what I can to you all to divide among you," Ray said.
"I say we sell the fiddle right now and split the money evenly. We can even divide by six so you can have your own share,"
Thurston said.
"That's a minimum of $1.6 million each."
"That's right," Ray's mom said.
"No," Ray said. "I know this came out of nowhere, but the best thing for me to do is..."
"The best thing for you to do is bring that violin back to Mama's house so we can figure out how to sell it. We finally have a chance to get rich, and you are about to fuck it up for all of us."
"Larry, stop,"
Aunt Rochelle said.
"You know it's true,"
Uncle Larry told her.
"That boy thinks he's all that because he's going to that white school."
Ray took a deep breath.
It didn't help.
"I'll tell you who I think I am. You never thought twice about that fiddle." "What did you say, boy?"
"You heard exactly what I said. My violin is not for sale."
"Well, looky here. Somebody finally grew a pair. Why are you doing this? How can you be so selfish?"
Uncle Larry asked.
Is this how I raised you? To only think about yourself?
His mother wanted to know. Ray couldn't help rolling his eyes.
I'm not thinking about myself. I'm thinking about Grandma and what she wanted. And she wanted me to play Pop-Pop's fiddle.
You know what? Fuck this, Uncle Thurston said. I'm calling a lawyer. I don't know who you think you are.
You know what? I tried, Ray told them. I'm not selling my violin. Good luck with your lawyer. Oh, and thanks for your support.
He ended the call, stared up at his poster of Optimus Prime.
That went much better than I thought it would. Don't you think?
The next morning, the front page of the Charlotte Herald ran the headline, Markham U student discovers Strad violin, and below it, estimated at $10 million. At 12:01 a.m., long before papers reached local front doorsteps, mailboxes, and stores, the electronic edition of the Charlotte Herald was posted online. By 12:23 a.m., Ray's phone was buzzing with numbers he didn't recognize. He received messages, emails, and texts from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, BBC News, the Today Show, People Magazine, and dozens of other media outlets. Janice had thought only the Charlotte Herald would care. She was wrong. The world woke up to the story of a young black violin prodigy who played on his grandmother's $10 million Stradivarius. The circus had begun. Part 4. Music Making.